Pod. 22 grand. Pod. In the city that sounds nice.
Huh. Yeah, how's it going? Anyway, is it Brooklyn you're in?
Right on the edge of Brooklyn. We're actually in Queens, Ridgewood. But, you know, I could like throw a rock to Brooklyn from here. So,
okay.
Where are you right now?
I'm in Manchester in England. I don't know if, I assume you guys have played it before.
Yeah. The Soup Kitchen. And, we came back a second time. I can't remember what the second venue was, but yeah.
Obviously, I'd like to get an idea of how things are going in America. Like, what's it like where you are?
It's, you know, it's like pretty heavy quarantine right now. It's starting to get real cold. So, you know, one great thing about life in New York under COVID is that they've been having outdoor dining basically at all the restaurants, which is something that's never happened here before. So they've shut down the streets and have like tables on the street at outside of bars and stuff. So it kind of feels like France or something like that. which is, it's like a, and people are like drinking on the street, which is normally like a no-no in New York. But so it actually made the city kind of have a more integrated feel for a little bit. But now that it's cold, that's not happening. So it's gone back to just lonely isolation again.
Wanted to ask like what you guys are up to. I mean, how old are you guys, if you don't mind me asking?
I'm 32.
Right, so exactly the same age as me then, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like looking back at those early 2000s, like in England, we've talked a lot about the UK guitar band scene, and obviously there was a lot going on in New York and stuff. Like, what were you up to at that time, and what were you listening to?
Well, you know, I was in the South Carolina suburbs at the time, so my first experience with music was kind of twofold. One was the big stuff that was on MTV at the time. It's like the first band I ever fell in love with, and like I guess it would have been probably 1999, was Korn. Which is, you know, I'm thrown in my timeline. I mean, I still have a soft spot for Korn. I think they're a pretty inventive band. But then simultaneously I was getting into local stuff. There was this band called Stretch Armstrong. I don't know if you remember them, but they were like a hardcore band from South Carolina, one of our hometown heroes. So, you know, like it was seeing like a kind of like DIY that was totally different from the, you know, the big alt rock stuff that was on the radio, you know. And then as I got a little bit older, you know, my tastes got a little wider. I think the first band I like totally claimed as my band was Jane's Addiction, right around the time when they did their you know, their big reunion in, I guess it would have been 2001 or something like that. You know, it was just a band that kind of became a gateway for me towards all kinds of things, whether it was like towards post-punk or towards Velvet Underground or towards more like classic rocky things like Led Zeppelin or something, or you know, or leaning towards other 90s bands like Smashing Pumpkins or something like that. That was a huge deal for like a 13-year-old to get into. You know, they're kind of like, they have like one foot in 80s underground metal and then one foot into the, you know, what I guess became like alternative. And so they're kind of like a forgotten band, even though they were like, you know, it's not like they weren't wildly successful, but there's, I don't see that many people talking about them much anymore. And to me, they're one of the greatest bands that ever was, even still. But, you know, they really only had 2 years of activity and that was it. So, you know, like, and they kind of have slowly ruined their legacy with reunions and reality shows and stuff like that. So, you know, I don't blame people for kind of not thinking about them much or anything. But yeah, like, I mean, from what I could tell, all the UK stuff, you know, which, you know, seems like in the same world as the Strokes and Yeah Yeahs and things like that, you know, that kind of trickled into my world, but not really. I didn't get really into those bands until much later, until like my 20s, honestly.
What reality shows with Jane's Addiction doing then, like an Osbournes type thing or something?
Yeah, Dave Navarro had a show with Carmen Electra when he was married to her. And, you know, he's become like a L.A., just kind of like, you know, he's more known for just being famous than I think he is for being a guitar guy anymore. You know, I think at a certain point in his life, he kind of stopped writing songs and started just like being cool and famous, you know?
Yeah. Fair play.
it's not like the most exciting thing to be a fan of, you know, when someone you think is like writing incredible songs and they just kind of stop, you know. I mean, it's his decision, but you know, you can continue being creative after you're 30, you know. I guess he decided he didn't want to do that, you know.
Yeah, I guess it's a bit disheartening when a band you like do stuff like that. Yeah,
exactly.
So in terms of you, like at what point were you getting into like your first bands and stuff like that?
Well, my first band was a cover band in the seventh grade. We did Green Day and Ramones, which was pretty fun. You know, I'm sure a lot of kids had similar experience. My first band of originals was in high school, and we kind of sounded like it was weird. When you're at that age, genre distinctions don't mean that much to you, you know? So, yeah. We did so many different things. We would do like kind of metal. We would do hardcore. We did some very like indie sounding stuff. We did some Strokes kind of knockoff songs, and we would do it all in the same song. So it'd be like the intro would sound like the Killers or something like that. And then all of a sudden it would go into this like metal riff section where we're playing the same hook, but like in a totally different genre, something like that only, you know, like a ninth grader would think is appropriate and works, you know. But there's like kind of, when I listen back to it, there's kind of a charm to it, because it's like, so there's like no rules whatsoever, you know. It's like
yeah, like none of it's like contrived or anything kind of thing.
Yeah, well, it's contrived in its own bizarre way. I mean, we're still trying real hard, you know. And at that age, unfortunately, like, you know, we would be getting into a lot of, I guess, what you would call emo type music. You know, that was a lot of what the local bands were doing in South Carolina. So we would have like a verse that would be like a whiny emo thing, but then it would go into like a kind of cool, you know, like bluesy chorus thing. And then all of a sudden we're doing a hardcore breakdown. And like the songs are all like 8 minutes long, you know, and don't need to be that long. I don't know. But yeah.
So yeah. So what point were you getting into, I don't know, don't want to say serious bands, but maybe, you know, we're playing proper shows and everything.
Yeah. Well, really college and when I moved to New York. So, I mean, I had a pretty good band in, I did my first 2 years of university in South Carolina. I had a pretty good band, but it was very, you know, we were like obsessed with the Animal Collective at the time. So it was kind of like a total Animal Collective ripoff. And then when I moved to New York, I had another band that was kind of like that. And then I started playing drums in a lot of bands. So I don't know, I was in like five or six bands that, you know, like all either only recorded like one song or were kind of like forgotten. You know, I spent most of my 20s, early 20s, like music was more of a social thing. It was never like, I was really serious about music, but I don't know. It felt like, I'm also a filmmaker, so I put a lot of my creative energy in my early 20s towards making films. And then it really wasn't until I was 24 that I started this band called Bodega Bay, which is basically Bodega, but like the early version of it. Nikki was also in that. And, you know, we only put out one record, really just a cassette that we self-released, which was kind of like is 33 tracks, and is basically all 33 songs we did in our 4 years together. And then when that band broke up, we kept going as Bodega, but kind of a new and improved version of that band.
Just going back to the point where you were at college, is that kind of like late 2000s?
Yeah, it would have been. Yeah, I started in 2006. So like the second half of the aughts.
Okay. And I mean, something we talk about on the podcast is how, like, I don't know if it's the same in America, but bands talk about the fact that, you know, record labels were throwing money at bands at that point, like trying to find the next Strokes or whatever. Yeah. And that kind of tailed off towards the end of the 2000s, obviously, like the impact of the internet and everything. Was that something you were aware of, or were you not really, you know, striving to get a record deal or anything like that at that point?
I mean, no, I wasn't. I was so in my own world that, you know, I was making CDRs and just giving them away at shows. I mean, it really wasn't until I moved to New York that I was taking the idea of being on a label seriously. But you know, I was so stupid. I don't know. I just would email people, and of course they never write back. You know, you probably have heard of the venue in New York, the Silent Barn. It's kind of it's since closed down, but, and there were two versions of it, but it was, you know, it's kind of, it's a DIY spot, but it became kind of legendary amongst indie bands. And I remember we had, I made an album that was totally self-released in 2011, I want to say. And we had our like release party at Silent Barn. There's maybe like, you know, it was pretty packed, maybe like 50 people there. And I remember thinking that was like, wow, we made it, you know? And I was like, surely someone's going to review this and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And of course, I think like, you know, 10 of the people that went to that show took home the CDR. I don't know. I was very naive. I didn't get more savvy about, you know, pitching myself to labels and stuff until fairly recently, honestly.
What age were you when you moved to New York then?
So I would have been 20.
Yeah, so obviously that was a pretty exciting time for you in terms of, well, I don't know, your life, but in terms of music as well.
Oh, yeah, it was like everything was new to me, you know, and I was doing college radio. I was being a DJ in South Carolina, which was so, it was like the best 2 years of music discovery for me. So I just went into the room where they had all the CDs and vinyls and just ripped them. And you know, this is pre-streaming. So I would have this giant library amassed and everything was new to me. I mean, yeah, it's hard to explain, but maybe for European and English listeners, but South Carolina is so isolated. It's so uncool. I thought I was the only person in the entire state of South Carolina who knew who Sonic Youth was, for example. So I didn't have any friends who were into the same thing as me, which I don't know, for better or worse, has kind of performed my, has created my unique perspective on music, I guess. But like, you know, I got really, really into, kind of, I had a shoegaze radio show for a while. And then I got really into post-punky stuff. I was a, you know, I would tell everyone The Fall was my favorite band, might still be, but you know, and no one in South Carolina knew who that was, which is probably shocking to someone that lives in Manchester, but I bet you there are five people in the whole state of South Carolina that know who The Fall are, you know? And that's not even an exaggeration. That's just, I don't know. It's a very completely different culture. And, so I knew I had to leave and go to New York. And it was kind of a culture shock because when I go to New York, you know, every other person has a Sonic Youth t-shirt on and they're not even cool. It's considered kind of corny to like Sonic Youth at that point, just kind of like, it's a big culture shock for me, but you know, but I think there's value in like, which, you know, I might be one of the last people because of my age to kind of experience something like that, where music that is still fairly successful feels like you're the only one in the world that knows about it, you know, because you can't have that experience on the internet. I mean, I'm sure I could have found people on message boards or something like that. I wasn't very savvy though. I don't know.
It's interesting though, because I was listening to an interview with Jack White last night, and he was saying, you're saying him and his cousin were the only people where he lived that are into like, you know, old blues stuff and that. And yeah, he kind of said it made them more determined in a way to like do their own thing.
Yeah, I can see that. I just re-listened to those first three White Stripes records for some reason a couple of days ago. Amazing records. They're so good.
Yeah. Yeah. He's over in England at the minute, cause I think they're releasing the greatest hits.
Oh yeah. That's why I was listening to it. Cause I was like, oh, greatest hits. Yeah. Weird. I haven't listened to that band in 10 years, you know?
Yeah. I wouldn't expect him. I don't know. I mean, obviously don't know him, but from what you read, you wouldn't expect him to do like a greatest hits, but maybe, I don't know, maybe COVID's hit him a bit harder, I don't know.
Maybe they need to fund the third man somehow, you know?
Yeah. So you talked about Bodega Bear. In terms of like lyrical content kind of thing, was that kind of similar to the music?
Exactly. Very similar. A lot of songs that became Bodega's staple songs on our first record were earlier Bodega Bay songs. So there's not that much of a discontinuity. One thing that was really different about Bodega Bay is we were, we had way more members and we were like sloppier in the sense that we practiced less and we tried everything. We did kind of like my high school band. We did every genre under the sun. You know, we'd play one show as a glam rock band, and the next show we're just doing an hour long drone because we just, I don't know, reconnected with Spaceman 3 or something. We were very like, I don't know, a thorough line I can see in my musical life is that I get bored just doing one thing. So I constantly am trying different things. And I think, you know, hopefully it's one of the things that makes Bodega unique is, we don't really just do one thing. Obviously, you know, we have a sound and an ethos, but you know, we'll do, fragile ballads and we'll do jangle pop songs and then we'll do really tough hardcore type songs. And, you know, hopefully it all fits in the same world. I think one of the bigger problems, in modern rock that I have just as a fan is that so many bands are, they just do one thing, you know, and they do it really well and it gets a little bit boring and it comes across to me as like a little too calculated. Like they're like, oh, we see this niche that, you know, there needs to be more bands that sound like the second Joy Division record. So we're going to fill that niche. And that just to me is so insanely boring.
Yeah. I read an article, but I'm not sure whether it was you or Nikki that said you'd like modern bands to be a bit more fearless, take a few more risks type thing.
Yeah. I'm glad that she said that out loud. It's like, sometimes I need to hear that, you know, it's tough cause it's not easy to be a band, just financially. So I get why people are tempted to do something that's going to easily sell, you know, like, oh, like people really seem to like this one song. So let's just pump out 12 versions of that same song for our next record, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that's something I was going to come on to. Like, I had a band called Kiwi Junior on who said,
oh, I love that band. Good band. Yes, we played with them before.
Oh, nice one. And like other bands are like similar age to me that have like been going, you know, in different guises for like 15 years and have really like had to kind of craft their way through to get to the point where they can do it full time. I mean, Kiwi Junior said they still have jobs, which I found crazy because they're signed to Sub Pop at the minute. But yeah, is that something you found you really like, you had to use that experience to get to the point where you are now?
Yeah. I mean, I find myself a lot of times when we're touring, that I'm like, wow, you know, it feels like I've been playing music for so long, but really I'm new to it in some sense. You know, we've only been an international touring band for like 2-3 years. So we're still a brand new band, but it's not like we're 18 and we just started playing yesterday, which, you know, that would have been cool. But also, we have a unique perspective because, you know, we have lived through a lot of things and, you know, everybody in the band does different art, as well. You know, like I said earlier, I'm a filmmaker, so I've spent a lot of my 20s doing that. I wasn't just dicking around, you know.
Yeah. But, I suppose it helps that you've listened to a lot more at this point as well.
Yeah, I've been rock obsessive for, you know, 20 plus years now. So yeah, I know what I like and I know what I don't like, you know.
Get to a point where you're just going to do what you're going to do kind of thing. You're not too worried about what other people think, maybe.
Yeah, and that's when art is most interesting, when you really feel like you're sneaking in on somebody's secret little world, and they're doing it for themselves, you know.
So just going back a little bit, like, just interested as, you know, as to how you met Nikki and everything and how you started that initial Bodega Bear band.
Do you know the band of Montreal, the Athens band?
Don't think so, no.
Great band. I highly recommend them. But I mean, they've been around for almost 25 years now or something, but they're one of my all-time favorite bands and they're one of the bands that I see like 3 times a year. And I remember going to see them back-to-back nights, probably back in 2012, 13 or something like that. And Nikki happened to be at one of the shows. And her roommate at the time that she was with had been, there was a retrospective earlier that week for Jean-Luc Godard. And they had played this 10-hour movie of his that he had made for TV in the 70s. It's a very obscure movie of his. And me and her roommate were the only two people that watched the whole 10 hours. There's only like 7 people in the theater, but it was just like the two of us at the end. We were dedicated soldiers of cinema. And so he recognized me and he's like, oh, that's the guy over there. he likes a Montreal and Godard. Wow, we should like make friends with him. So immediately I asked both of them to join Bodega Bay, and they're like, we don't play music. It's like, that's not a problem. Bodega Bay, and to a certain extent, Bodega, they're more like conceptual projects than we are, you know, musicians. I mean, we are musicians, but, you know, to me, it's always been more about the ideas and certain gestures we do. But yeah, so we they joined. I already had the band going at that point, but then they joined and started influencing the energy of it. And before too long, I started dating Nikki, and then that's when we started Bodega, and it really became kind of me and Nikki's band.
I mean, that's not really a dynamic we've spoken too much about on the podcast. We've spoken to people where, well, in fact, the last podcast was the Subways, and they were together and then split up, but like carried on. Yeah. Did it make you a bit more of a, I don't know, like a solid team?
Yeah, I think so. I think if anything, it's just better. I'm not sure how it is for the band. It's good for our relationship, though. So I think one of the keys towards sustaining a sort of erotic energy is creativity. And so the fact that we have she works on me with my films too. So the fact that we have all these adventures to go on together, both intellectually and creatively, kind of sustains our connection, I think. Yeah, it makes it so there's never really a dull moment, you know?
And it must be cool, like, obviously, when you're reaching goals and, like, kind of living out your dreams, really, together.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. when I first pitched her to be my girlfriend, I was like, look, you know, this isn't really just about, us getting together. It's about all these things we're going to do together. I was a pretty shrewd salesman. So far, like, my plan is kind of mapped out.
Like promising a main stage festivals and stuff like that.
Exactly. Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I guess a bit of a broad question, but can you like tell us how you went from that point to eventually getting on a record deal and, getting to the point where you are now, kind of thing?
It was just playing a lot of shows. You know, we had a pretty cracking live band in 2016, and we were playing like twice a week. I don't know if you've heard of this label. It's called Dull Tools. It's a DIY label in New York, and it's Andrew from Parquet Courts. It's like his boutique label, I guess. And he runs it with this guy named Chris Pickering, a band called Future Punks, and his girlfriend Heather Strange, who's also in Future Punks. And so, I thought they were the coolest label in town. And so our goal, or at least my goal, was to make a record that was interesting enough to be put out by them. And we even ended up working with Austin Brown from Parquet Courts. He's not involved with Dull Tools, but I don't know. It's all kind of in the same little orbit in our small Brooklyn scene. And we ended up making a record that a lot more people wanted to put out. And, you know, no offense to Dull Tools, but they can't give bands any money to tour and things like that. So we ended up going with this label called What's Your Rupture. We were able to, because of that, tour the UK and even go to Asia and things like that.
And I mean, Kiwi Junior said they recorded their album before they got picked up by a label. Was that similar with you, or did the label?
No, we did it all DIY, and then we sent it to a bunch of labels, you know. Kind of interesting because, you know, for anybody who's listening to this and is in a band and is looking for advice, and people always ask us this, I would say just make your own record. Don't wait for anybody to give you permission. And, you know, even after we made our record, we sent it to a bunch of labels and nobody even opened the emails, you know. But then once they saw us around town, you know, they started to be like, oh, wait. We would have put this out. We just didn't. It's no disrespect. They just, you know, I'm sure they get a ton of emails and just put them right in spam, you know. You kind of have to make your own chance happen, but you got to continually put yourself out there, and you can't wait for permission.
Getting recorded by Austin from Parquet Courts. You say they're quite like selective in terms of the bands they take on then.
Yeah, I think he had recorded one other band, this band called Rips. That's a pretty good, actually really good Brooklyn band. Yeah, I think he saw us at a show and was like, hey, have you guys ever recorded? And we're like, not yet. And he's like, oh, well, I have my studio like totally set up to record now. Cause we've been working on demos for their new record. And he goes, why don't you come by one weekend and we'll record. And I said, great. We got 17 songs. And so like, we ended up like, you know, making a whole record in like 4 days or something like that. I'm not sure whether he had a full length in mind or not, but it worked out good.
You always have a strong idea of how you want the music to sound. We've talked to people who say like producers kind of informed the way they played live, but I guess maybe that's for younger bands. Are you kind of, did you know what you wanted from the album when you went in to record it?
Yeah, we had done so much pre-production. We had already done like a whole version of the songs demo wise that, you know, we had totally done on our own. So when we went to do it with, Austin, we just played basically our set that we had at the time, totally live. And, you know, we overdubbed the vocals afterwards, but the only, real, input he gave was in the vocal performances, which, you know, was super helpful, you know, just something as simple as, you know, give this line more energy or, you know, in some rare cases, like, why don't you, you know, develop that melody idea you have a little bit more, make it a little bit catchier. I mean, it happened so fast. We did all in like 4 days, like I said, but you know, also a big part of it is, because I'm a fan of his band, I wanted to impress him naturally. So, you know, performing live for someone you admire, makes you put a little bit of extra spark into it. I think that was helpful. But yeah, I mean like other records we've done since then, you know, we did a mini record last year and we just wrapped up a record that's going to come out next year. We're totally different experiences, much more like, spending a lot of time in the studio and doing a lot of overdubs and, you know, just experimenting with different ways to record, you know.
In terms of songwriting then, like how does it work? Do you write a lot of the songs or is it more collaborative with Nicky and stuff?
Yeah. I mean, this is sort of a strange philosophical question, but I guess I would say, what do you consider songwriting? Because, you know, me and Nicky write our, in my case, either a bass line or some basic chord changes, and then I write the lyrics over it. And then she does the same for her songs. But then when we really start developing it in pre-production, then, you know, other people add things to it. Like in the past with Endless Scroll, this guy Madison, he's not playing with us anymore, but he was a big part of the band then, you know, he would help write help come up with some of the arrangements and, you know, maybe some of the lead guitar stuff. And now you know, there's this guy Dan that's playing with us now. He kind of has taken over that role. And you know, it's every song is different, but yeah, I mean, we kind of have a rule of, you know, whoever is singing the song kind of does the majority of the writing. It just tends to come out better that way. Because if someone really has something to express, they should kind of get the final say on the arrangement, you know.
I scroll down the endless scroll, endlessly scrolling like scroll, like click.
Just following on from songwriting and just looking at, you know, the contents of your lyrics and everything. Seems to be social commentary about, you know, screens, scrolling. Is that like a genuine concern for the way we live, or is it just more of an observation, really?
Well, it's both. It's twofold. Well, naturally, I think when we look back on this moment in time, we'll see that the most important thing that's happening is this historical change, which is our of how our relationship to technology is changing. And it's almost like, so in one hand, it's an observation. I'm sort of being an anthropologist and just like watching how we're really evolving as a species. We're becoming androids. And there's the moralist side of it. You know, I think anyone who writes songs, anyone who writes books, anyone who writes films, whether they admit to it or not, has a bit of a moralist in them. I certainly do. Where you're critiquing the world. I've always have been wary of how much our own thoughts are not even our own thoughts. We're not thinking, we're being thought by the world, by our circumstances, by the TV we watch, by the movies we watch, by what our friends say. I'm always constantly questioning my own thoughts and saying, Ben, is this really your own thought or is someone else thinking for you right now? You know, it's, I mean, it's a pretty classic punk rock theme. And so it's applying this sort of screen observation to that. I see the way people act on the internet, on social media and things like that as not being authentic. And what I mean by that is when someone is like typing on Twitter or posting on Instagram, they're being thought by the apparatus, basically. They're performing in a way that is not true to what they are actually thinking and experiencing in the world. They're adapting. It's like so many people are chameleons. It's not necessarily a bad thing, but you know, if I go into a room with my dad, I'm going to talk to him one way. If I go into a room with my record label, I'm going to talk another way. If I go into a room with a stranger, I'm a completely different person in each scenario. And I think like the way people act online is even crazier. The jump there, it's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, there's something kind of liberating about it, but I can see the potential for problems. And I would just say from a purely first person POV perspective, my world has gotten a lot smaller ever since I started using a phone. Instead of getting bigger, the world has gotten so much smaller.
Yeah, well, just in the way everything's connected, you mean?
Just my thoughts are so much less interesting.
Right, okay. Yeah, I mean, I watched a Netflix documentary called Social Dilemma, which kind of agrees with some of the things you're saying. Is that something you've seen by any chance?
I haven't, no. It sounds good, though.
Yeah, I mean, I think off the back of it, a lot of people deleted their Instagram for about a week, probably. But
wow.
Like you say, it kind of just says how like the apps are playing you rather than the other way around kind of thing. And that you're just kind of a commodity to all these companies. Because I guess when you think of something like Instagram being free, you don't really think too much about it. But it kind of talks about you being the commodity that they're selling kind of thing, basically.
Yeah.
It's all kind of interesting stuff.
The same thing happens with streaming services per se, you know, like, I don't know, you probably noticed it. Yesterday was the day that Spotify releases their data where they tell you what your top five artists were or whatever. And to a certain extent, it's kind of a fun game to text all your friends and say, hey, what was your top five this year? Cause it is kind of a fun way to see where you were at that year, but also it's just free advertising for Spotify. And it's kind of insidious how much everyone just shares that free advertising.
Yeah. I mean, I wanted to ask you about Spotify and streaming, like what's your view on it? I mean, do you think it makes life a lot harder for new bands starting out? Like what's your opinion?
Yeah, definitely. Cause they don't pay anything. And the biggest thing that I think Spotify does that's negative, even more so than how much they exploit artists financially, is they devalue art. I hate the idea of music being used to just trigger an emotion. So like when you see these playlists that are like chill out studying jazz, you know, and it has Miles Davis on it, you know, it's so offensive to Miles Davis to think that he made this music for you to chill out and study to, you know what I mean? As if you can reduce it to that, you know, or like this idea that the whole point of music is to just kind of become like a wallpaper. That's like a good musical performance encompasses so many different emotions, not even just lyrically. But I mean, that's a good place to start. Like a songwriter in one line could be expressing resentment towards somebody just two words later, two inflections of their voice later, they're expressing, you know, anger towards someone. Then they're expressing a great amount of love towards someone. And this all happens within 3 seconds in a good musical performance. And it happens in this almost magical way that unless you're really paying attention, you might not get. And to me, Spotify is kind of doing this thing where they're like, each song can be quantified towards one thing. Like this is moody, rainy music. You know, it's just like, to me, it's a great disservice to music to think of a song as just like being equivalent to like one thing, you know, a good work of art. It like, it triggers off all these, open-ended, kinds of emotions. It's not even intellectual. It's something that happens And it's different every time. And, you know, you could use Spotify and still be, you know, art is only as ever as interesting as the observer. So, you know, if you're a patient and extremely interested and curious listener, you could still have a great aesthetic experience listening to Spotify. But I think they definitely program music listeners to not listen in that way, which I find slightly insidious, because it's in their best interest to devalue art and turn it into a thing that just algorithms can make. And, you know, and I think they're smart. They realize music's function in the world is mostly background music. So then, and they're tapping into that great need. I think a lot of people that aren't big music fans think of music as just kind of like a wallpaper or a furniture, you know, like something to put on when you're exercising or something to put on at a cocktail party or something like that. But it's, you know, any great music lover knows it's far more than that. It opens up an entire vista and is consciousness changing.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously I guess you would want to see Spotify pair artists more, or how would you want things to pan out?
Yeah, they should, that'd be, you know, a first step. Is paying people way more. I'm sure you've heard of this thing. They started introducing this new program where bands can opt to get paid less. And then their songs will show up on more playlists. So it's kind of like a weird new payola kind of thing. And you can see how, if you're a new band and you're trying to, you know, it's more important to you to just get exposure than it is to make money at that point in your career, I guess, you might go for something like that. And so that's highly exploitative, you know. It's similar to like having like an unpaid internship for like 10 years or something, you know what I mean? It's like, we know you love working in the arts, so we can easily exploit you. It's kind of insidious.
But yeah, I mean, we talked to people like Alan McGee, who kind of said, I think basically the big record labels have kind of got a monopoly on streaming now, and
yeah,
it's very, very unlikely that they're going to change. But I guess maybe with things like COVID, they'll be forced to make a decision where they have to support people more. I don't know.
I mean, they're going to be forced to do whatever their, you know, shareholders want them to do, which is going to be just make them more money. They don't give a fuck about anybody, but you know, they're like any big corporation. They don't care about anything other than just making more money and possibly having woke optics, which is, you know, in their best interest to make more money, you know?
So yeah. And just in terms of that, like, you know, the whole staring at a screen and everything, is that something you naturally remove yourself from, or is there a bit of a conflict when you're, you know, using Instagram to promote the band and everything, or are you quite comfortable in the way that you use it kind of thing?
Yeah, well, I mean, as a band, you kind of have to use those things if you want to play the game, so to speak. I mean, even just the way we record music now, it's, you know, Pro Tools is on the computer, so I'm still looking at Pro Tools 8 hours a day. You know, it's hard not to be a hypocrite when critiquing these things. And I think that's okay. I think putting a highlighter towards your own hypocrisy is maybe the first step. You know, I'm not telling everybody to throw away their phones. I'm just telling everyone to be aware of how it's affecting them.
Thanks for listening to this episode of 22 Gram Pod. If Naughty's guitar music is your thing, then you might enjoy our Patreon page, where for £3 a month, you will get access to the following series. The Naughty's Deep Dive, where we go through the likes of the Stalking Pete Doherty documentary in painful detail. My favourite 2000s album, where patrons and other guests come on to talk about their favourite album of the era. Legend or Landfill, in which we go through Enemy's top 10 albums of each year from 2001 and see if we think they are indeed legendary or for the landfill. Unsigned Stories, where we chat to bands that didn't quite make it in terms of signing that elusive record deal. We also have Fan Stories, where I talk to people about their memories and opinions on all things Naughty's Indie. You also get early access to any main podcast episodes, and it's also worth checking out the YouTube page, where you can see extended video versions of the interviews, as well as plenty of other bits of commentary and opinion. All links are in the description. Now back to the pod.
And then, yeah, if you just look at your impact in the UK, I mean, we've talked to bands like The Rapture, who said they kind of followed a bit of a blueprint in terms of almost making it in the UK before they did America.
Yeah.
Is that kind of a route you've gone down?
That's 100% the same route. Yeah. It's a tale as old as time in rock and roll. Yeah. I don't know why. I think you guys have an infrastructure set up there. It might have to do with the BBC, now BBC Six. I think it just has to do with rock culture. It just has a way bigger footprint there. And I think, I don't know, it's the US is so big, and I think rock is only really a big deal in maybe like 10 US cities, you know, and they're all so far spread out, you know, talking like, you know, Minneapolis, Detroit, Austin, Chicago, New York, Nashville, LA, Seattle, Portland, you know, that's about it everywhere. And then you got about 1,000 miles between some of those cities. So what else is there? You know what I mean? And none of those people are remotely interested about new bands. I mean, obviously there are teenagers there like me who, you know, are, but not on like a cultural level in the same way, which is, you know, kind of amazing when you go to, say London or Manchester, you really realize that, okay, like rock music is still like kind of part of pop culture there in a way. It's just not in America. I'm not really sure why that is. You might know more than me, but.
No, like, I've always thought maybe it's because, like, say it's, so much bigger in America, and it's a lot easier for scenes to form in England, I think, because of its size. But I mean,
yeah,
I'm just guessing at that. Like you say, it's easy with things like Six Music that you know where to go for that music. I don't know if in America, where is it a lot more spread out in terms of, I don't know, like, do you almost get different radio stations in different places kind of thing?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You have your good college radio stations and things like that, but it's, yeah, it's not, Because we don't have like a state subsidized thing like the BBC, which is has great tastemakers, and it's like, you know, it's not only like a fun radio station to listen to, but you know, it has some kind of validity to it. You know, like the people making the playlists, they're not just algorithms, and they're not just bought out by you know, the major labels. They're people that are actually curating. So it's fun to follow, you know what I mean?
So yeah, what was your experience of coming over to England then? Like, I saw an Enemy article where, well, actually, the first time I heard about you guys was in the Enemy, where it said you were the best band you'll see anywhere at South by Southwest in 2018.
Oh, yeah.
Things kind of kick on from there a bit in terms of your reception in England.
Yeah, we went to England maybe a month or two after that. And yeah, it was super fun. It was, we had just done a tour opening for Franz Ferdinand in America. So that was also a huge kind of big step for us. It was the first time we played huge theaters, you know, as opposed to DIY clubs. And right after that, we went to England. So, you know, that those 2 months were, you know, kind of the origin point of our band kind of like entering England's consciousness, I think, you know. It was also right around the time we put out our first record. So yeah, I mean, we were hoping to be playing in the UK like now, but you know, obviously with COVID and everything, we won't be able to get back for a while. But yeah, I love playing there. It's weird. And I guess like my own taste as a music fan, I don't know, really strongly connected to the kind of the audiences we play to there. I don't know. I feel like I understand them in a way that I don't certain American audiences, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I saw you around that time. You were supporting a band, can I remember, sort of sound stupid. Rolling Blackouts, is it?
Oh yeah. Coastal Fever. Yeah. Yeah. Great band. Yeah.
Yeah. The Electric Ballroom.
Oh yeah.
And, yeah, I mean, your live performances make a really big impact in terms of the things you have set up, and obviously kind of the sound bites that you have on the album of, you know, the computer voices and everything. Is that kind of sounds like the art side of things is very important. So is that important when it comes to the live shows as well?
Yeah. We want to make something that is a little, not just a band plugging in and playing, you know, there's a little bit of extra thought put in the performance. You know, our show is not necessarily scripted in the same way a play is, but I'm often thinking of theater. I think of myself as an actor when I'm singing a lot too. you know, so some of the songs are autobiographical, but they're, you know, I'm not always the same Ben. I'm tapping into one side of Ben in How Did This Happen? Whereas, like, you know, the Ben that sings, say, a song like Charlie or something, that's a different side of Ben. And what makes a performance my favorite part of being in a band is because it has that aspect of acting to it, where you're tapping into a different side of yourself, and it's never the same. It's always, you know, every single time you sing a song is different. And you know, as a music fan, I've always thought of, you know, live shows as the most rewarding place, because it's the one arena of the whole music culture where you're closest to the artist in the moment of creation. Whereas when you're listening to an album, you're listening to something that was so heavily edited and you know, curated and polished, and there's something, you know, that's fine about that, but there's something much more raw and unpredictable about a live show that you know, I just can't get enough of. So you know, knowing that when we tour, we try to put together a show that's going to be a little bit different every night. And also just kind of like, play with the rules and the form of the live show. You know what I mean? Like, you know, there's certain codes that you follow when you perform as a rock band, and being aware of them and kind of messing with them a little bit is fun, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, around that time, you must have, it must have been fun watching the audience's reaction, because I remember there's a song. What's the opening song on the set list? Sorry, at that time. Song where you came out and the intro was about 10 times longer than it is on the album.
Oh, Can't Knock the Hustle.
Can't Knock the Hustle, that's it, right?
Yeah.
Was it quite, I mean, within the lyrics and stuff, there seems to be quite like a bit of a humor element. Was it quite...
Yeah.
Funny watching people's reactions to that when you first start playing, they have no idea. Well, it's obviously a lot of people knew who you were, but when you're supporting someone, they're like, right, what's going on here?
Yeah, like using repetition is a pretty good tool to like shake people out of their slumber. You know, if you play an intro for 10 seconds, it just sounds like an intro. But if you play it for 10 minutes, then people are like, what's going on here? You know, it kind of unlocks a different part of your brain. So we use tricks like that to make people like way more aware of the present moment, you know?
Yeah, no, it definitely works.
Also, it just sounds good. Repetition always works. It like gets your body into a groove, you know?
Yeah, I heard someone told me that kind of the human brain really responds to like repetition of patterns and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Anyway,
that's how music works, by, you know, repetition and various permutations of interesting repetition.
Then yeah, I just wanted to talk about individual songs. Like, obviously, How Did It Happen seems to be the first song that really broke through.
Yeah.
Is that? Did you know that was going to be the one that kind of would lead the way?
No, you never know. I don't know. When we wrote that song, it was just another song. It was an important song because it was the last one we wrote for the album. And it was me sort of addressing the 2016 American presidential election. And so it felt like I needed to, me personally, I had to write a song about that. And so we wrote it really, really fast. And it was the only one that we hadn't played live beforehand, and just kind of threw it on there. And maybe because of that spontaneity, it kind of had like a little magic to it. But yeah, you never know. I don't know. Some of the songs that I thought weren't that good ended up being people's favorite songs. So you never know.
Yeah. You hear that quite a few times, where the songs that are written in the fastest time often being the biggest songs for some reason. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like when you try hard, you die hard, you know?
I just wanted to ask you, what was the inspiration behind Jack and Titanic? Obviously, like I said about the humor elements, obviously a bit of that in there. Like, yeah, just tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, it's a bit of a kind of shapeshifter of a song, because, you know, part of it comes from kind of this political critique, really, about how the person who I am is not necessarily me. It's what I've inherited from the films I've watched. So, like, when I was first courting Nikki, you know, we watched Titanic, and then I realized in like the days after we watched it, because, you know, it's one of her favorite movies, that I realized I was like acting like the Jack character. And I realized that I saw that movie at a really impressionable age in 1997 or something. And that maybe my idea of how a boy should act all stem from that character. And then, but, you know, so that's, you know, there's sort of a cerebral intellectual side of the song, but then there's also sort of a libidinous id let loose in the lyric that I've sort of come to terms with, where it's not so ironic. And some of it is just me actually with a bit of swagger, actually just saying things out loud that I wish I could have said to Nikki at the time. Maybe it's a bizarre song. And I think part of its power is that you can't exactly pin it down. It's kind of an earnest song as well as it's like a highly ironic song. And it really depends on how I perform it night to night, which version you're going to get, you know?
Yeah. No, I like it. Sorry, I meant to follow up on your comment about the US election. Cause obviously one of the lyrics in How Did It Happen is, you know, guitars don't kill fascists. Was that kind of a call for people to get out there and make sure a certain person didn't get in?
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, how did this happen is, it's a complicated song. It's about the guilt of the left and the impotence of a certain kind of leftism on the internet. And, you know, it's not something as simple as, oh, you know, this bozo should not be our president. Anyone who has a brain knows that, you know, at least of a certain kind of, at least in our little world in New York, right? What became to me more important to say in song was to critique myself and my peers for our, in some ways, our political complacency. It's like easy to be on the internet and point fingers at other people, when meanwhile I've just gone to band practice and I'm going to Barnes and Noble. I don't, you know, the song doesn't have any easy answers. It's like putting a highlighter towards my own guilt. And it's also pointing out the hypocrisy of Hillary Clinton supporters. It's just real. It's, you know, we're not exactly a political band in the way like a band like Idols is. We don't slogan. We're not really, about rallying a bunch of people together in the same way they do. And I think they do a great job at doing it. And I think they're highly effective as political organizers. That's not really what Bodega is about. Bodega is kind of it's more the feeling I was trying to get in that song is slightly more complicated. You know, it's about trying to pinpoint exactly what went wrong politically with my generation. And there's not any really easy answers. And, you know, I think that's what art is good at, is asking questions.
Yeah, it's an interesting point you say about Idols. Like you said, they're pretty like, well, they are genuine with what they're saying, their lyrical content and everything. And I saw a comment that you said about, with rock and roll, you can smell when something doesn't really come from someone's gut and blood.
Yeah.
And I thought it was a really good way of putting it. Kind of, you can tell when people are using something to kind of give them a bit of a personality rather than something that comes from their, like you say, their gut kind of thing.
Yeah. So. I mean, like, just talking about Idols, it's clear that what they're doing is earnest. I'm not criticizing them or anything. I'm just saying that's not what we do, you know? And when we first came out, people were kind of lumping us in with them, and I was a little bit confused because, you know, it's, we're both obviously, I guess, what you would call, you know, sort of leftist thinking bands, but we're different flavors of it, you know, for better or worse. I actually kind of admire what they do politically. And, you know, you can tell they've created a whole community of people, which, you know, I admire. But there's, you know, there's a part of me that is skeptical of groups like that, you know. If a bunch of people get together and all are agreeing on a thing, you know, for whatever reason, you know, maybe it's the American in me, something seems false to me, you know. But I think that's a critique of myself as well, in that, you know, this is why I've never earnestly, except for maybe the exception being Bernie Sanders, if you know who that is, have never ever believed in a political movement. I'm just far too skeptical of politics in general, you know. But thank God I'm not a politician, you know. I'm an artist, you know. And I actually think what Joe and Idols is doing is political work, you know. He's more of like a union organizer than, you know what I mean?
he's like
the punk rock Bono or something like that.
Yeah. Wonder why you'd make of that. You mentioned you recorded an EP. Was it last year?
Yeah. Came out, I guess. Yeah, it feels like 10 years ago, but yeah, it was 2019.
Yeah, how do you think your sound has moved on from the first album, if it has, kind of thing?
Well, like I said, we just recorded a whole new record. So
yeah, sure,
that's where kind of where my mind is at. But I definitely can hear now how the EP was kind of maybe a stepping stone towards what we're doing now. Just kind of branching out and trying different flavors of Bodega, you know. We spent more time in the studio with that EP. It's not just us playing live. We put some more work into the guitar textures and things like that. And we also did that in our new one. So it's a little bit more, it's a little bit less minimal, you know. I'm not saying that it's better or worse. It's just different, you know. I think that's the key towards a creative life, is just trying new things all the time.
Yeah. I mean, you've had bands on who, you know, like they're five albums in, but they've managed to make every album fresh, and they've kind of put that down to doing everything on your own terms. Is that obviously something you're trying to do?
Exactly. Yeah. I think, yeah, that's really what success is for a band, is doing what you want to do and, I've always thought quantity over quality is a good motto for a creative life. Obviously you want everything to be quality, but you can't ever put too much weight on one show or one song. It's not good for the art. And success from without, you have nothing. It's outside of your control. You can only control what you do. So success for me is, you know, making stuff that I'm proud of, and I feel like reflects where I'm at, and then moving on to the next thing.
Yeah, I mentioned that Kiwi Junior said they still have to have jobs, but are you guys in a position where you can do, well, I know you've got other projects and stuff, where you can do what you want to basically full time?
Geez, not really, no. We're probably in a similar financial world as Kiwi Junior. I'm lucky enough in that I have a film that I just sold. You know, I'm a filmmaker as well. So, that's kind of the other world that I live in. But, you know, right now we've been living off some unemployment and some money we saved up. So nobody in the group is, well, our new bass player is actually a college professor. So he's working. But we're kind of in a precarious spot. We'll see what happens. Hopefully we can start touring again. Otherwise we're going to, you know, have to go back to working 9 to 5s.
Like you're saying about your filmmaking, I saw something on the Bodega Instagram where you're going to gigs in Brooklyn and interviewing your favorite bands. Is that something? Talk a lot about the community of bands and whether, you know, bands feel part of a community of bands. Is there a strong community in Brooklyn?
There is. Definitely there is. I mean, there's so many bands in Brooklyn. There's probably like 10,000 bands, but... So there's like probably like, you know, 50 communities that all sort of interlap in different ways. We definitely have our own. But yeah, like me and Nikki thought it would be fun to go to shows and sort of be, you know, we're both filmmakers. So we thought we'd flex that a little bit and be documentarians. So we did that video for our friends, Gustav. We want to make more of those, but then COVID hit, you know.
Just interested in the film. If so, yeah. What's the story with that?
So it's called Private Chat, and it's sort of an erotic thriller about this guy who falls in love with a cam girl. If you saw Uncut Gems, Julia Fox is the cam girl in it. And my friend Peter Vack plays the protagonist. And actually, Austin from Parquet Courts did the score. And Nikki also acts in it. So it's kind of, it's a sexy movie, kind of a thriller, also kind of a romantic comedy in a weird way. It's kind of, I would say it's like an S&M tinge romantic comedy, but it's coming out in February on, streaming services and stuff. And I know, a company picked it up in UK. So if allowed, it may even do a little short theatrical run there, but, yeah, people keep an eye out for it. It's called Private Chat, PVT Chat.
Yes, definitely will do. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's something I read as well. Like you mentioned, like sexy kind of thing. And I saw a quote from Nikki where she was saying she wanted to kind of like bring back a, I don't know, like a sexiness to rock music. Is that kind of something you all feel?
Definitely. I feel like, well, just from our experience, a lot of underground rock music in America has been kind of sexless, you know? I don't know if that's the case. I don't feel like that's necessarily true of a lot of UK bands that I see. I think a lot of UK bands are more like fashion conscious, you know, they understand that dressing sexy is kind of an integral part of the whole experience of a show. Whereas I feel like a lot of American bands will show up on stage, wearing, you know, t-shirts and sandals. You know what I mean? Like the presentation is not, I think it has something to do with American culture. Like, you know, we really value an authenticity. So putting on airs is really offensive. Whereas in England, I think it's like perfectly acceptable to put on airs because everybody knows it's all a show anyway. And we much more relate to that sensibility of like, we're not wearing what we wore to work on stage. We're going to dress up a certain way and we're going to act a certain way. And you're seeing an idealized version of who we are, you know? And, you know, Nikki, I think, is inspired by writing about her sexuality, as I am too. I mean, kind of like what I was saying about, you know, Jack and Titanic in some ways is me expressing my own male sexuality. You know, especially in indie rock, it's kind of scoffed at to sing about sex. I think people are like a little bit embarrassed by, some of the sleazier, sexy things from rock's past, like, you know, Rolling Stones or Led Zeppelin or something like that. But, you know, we like that sexy aspect of the show, you know?
Yeah. That's another thing. Luke Jenner from The Rap just kind of said is that, you know, with the UK and with that scene, fashion was a big part of it, especially when I was younger.
The Rapture are a good example of a band that was sexy and, you know, kind of, you can see why they hit in UK, you know, they're from that world.
Yeah. And then just in terms of new album then, Ben, I don't know if you've mentioned when it's coming out, but, when is it coming out?
I think a lot is up in the air about what happens in the music industry, in terms of when shows can happen again. It'll probably be quite a while if I had to guess. I'm hoping next summer, but you know, it's not really up to me.
Yeah,
we'll see. Yeah.
And just in terms of everything that's happening at the minute, I've just been interested in, you know, we've had some people who said it's made them much more creative. I think Kiwi Junior said they basically recorded the full new album during COVID. I just wondered if it made you guys any more creative or how have you felt about it?
Yeah, I'm not sure it made us more creative, but we definitely made our whole new record during this time. So, you know, we were going to do it anyway, but now we have, you know, I guess a whole lot less distractions. I think maybe, you know, if it wouldn't have been quarantine, we might have made a different record, you know, and it might not even be better. It would just be different, you know.
Can we ask people who were in bands back in the day and they kind of got a leg up from the bigger bands at that time. I just wondered if any established bands that kind of reached out to you guys and have helped you out. Obviously you mentioned like supporting the likes of Franz Ferdinand and stuff.
Yeah, I would like to shout them out. They've been super supportive, not only taking us on tour, but kind of in a weird way. Mentoring's maybe not the right word, but they, and anytime we play, you know, in either Scotland or London, they'll come to the shows and, you know, treat us as peers in some sense, which is, you know, been very powerful. And they have a lot of wisdom to share about performing and a life in music. And, you know, and I can tell they do that with a lot of bands. You know, if you look at who they take on as their opening act, it's always like really exciting people. So, you know, grateful for them.
Yeah, talking to people on here, I didn't realize how big they were in America, but it sounds like they were kind of one of the biggest UK bands in America for a while.
Yeah, I think they were big in South Carolina, so you know they cut through. You know, on the radio you'd hear you know, like Nickelback, and then you'd hear a Franz Ferdinand or something, you know, like, like, or, and then you'd hear Linkin Park, and then maybe a Nirvana throwback or something, you know. It's like, that's, you know, if they could crack through that top 40 rock radio in rural South Carolina, you know, that they, you know, they're on that, that very rare 1% of, you know, the, whatever the powers that be like accepted it. And for a band that was doing something, you know, very unique at that time, it wasn't, it had nothing to do with all like the butt rock that was big on the radio. So, it was, you know, and they were still able to cut in corporate radio. That was something, you know.
It's a bit of a vague last question, but I just wondered if you did have any funny stories about any big names of the noughties period, like any funny stories about touring with the Franz Ferdinand guys or anything like that.
Well, I will say, like, probably our biggest, the biggest star we bumped into is, we did a tour with Metronomy in February, right before this whole COVID thing. And Josh Homme from Queens of the Stone Age came to one of the shows, because I guess he's friends with somebody in that band, or I think somebody in their band used to like be his guitar tech or something like that. But it's pretty wild in LA, you know, we go backstage and he's there, and he's so tall. He's like as tall as a basketball player. He must be like 6'5" or something. And, you know, he has all the bodyguards and, you know, some model girl with him. I mean, he definitely, you know, like, like seeing him to me is like, seeing Elvis or something. He has that same sort of like, macho, like this iconic American macho-ism that's like, feels like it's like otherworldly kind of. So seeing him there was like, whoa. I mean, I don't think he saw our set or anything, but you know, yeah, I think Madison said something to him like, "Hi, I'm Madison. Can I get you a drink?" And he's like, "I'm good. Thank you."
At least you had a go. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny that you had bodyguards with him. I wouldn't have expected that, but maybe he has to do that.
Well, it's LA, you know, everybody's got to make a big entrance.